Welcome back to the weekly roundup with Dewa de Boer and William McGimsey for RCR Plus, where we go back through the previous week's event in about half an hour, at least that's our target, which is a short space of time to sum up a busy week, but we will pick out some of the highlights and discuss them. Welcome back to the show, William.
Thanks, Theo. It's good to be here again.
And as always, to the listeners, please, you can send in your feedback by emailing inbox@realitycheck.radio or texting on 2057. Now, straight into it, the big reveal this week around Manurewa Marae, basically the Public Service Commission released this report specifically around the misuse of information. Of census data, election data, and sorry, I should specifically mention the ministries here. It was Stats, the Ministry of Health and Health NZ, and the Wairarapa Trust, and some other organizations connected to John Tamahere. They were all caught up in this damning report to basically say that there, well, it didn't say that there was corruption, but it skirted around it and basically said there was a lot of corruption around the way that the data was handled by the Manurewa Marae.
Yeah, so they misused New Zealand citizens' data. So, and data security is a big and important thing. The government is the biggest collector of our data, or at least one of, and they have very strong legal responsibilities to make sure that that data is secure. And what it appears like, although it's not fully confirmed, but that the data, this is the allegations at least, the data was collected. So they did deals, the government did deals with Manurewa Marae to collect the data. And then the Manurewa Marae people kept the data, photocopied it, or duplicated it in some way, and then used it for electioneering. Now, the reports don't exactly say that is what has happened yet, but they say that they didn't manage the data correctly, they didn't safeguard it, and there were several conflicts of interest that they didn't manage well. And basically, in not so many words, it says, they created a situation where there were so many conflicts of interest, it was a bit silly. So they should never have, in not so many words, that means they shouldn't have did a deal with the Manurewa Marae people when it was a voting place and Tash Kent was standing as a candidate. But what I mean, what I think about this with the conflicts of interest thing, the government has a lot of conflicts of interest when it comes to Maori things and iwi organisations. It's extremely conflicted, and it has a lot of conflicts in other ways as well. It's not, and those conflicts are so bad that it sort of brings into question its ability to conduct its business, including providing policy advice in a way that's fair and neutral. If we remember back to the way the media got its money from the Public Interest Journalism Fund. The problem there was, in order to get the money, they had to sign a contract to cover things in a certain way and aligned with the treaty principles. And there's a lot of kind of agreements and stuff in the government where they have to do things in line with the treaty principles too. And if you have a requirement to provide fair and neutral and accurate policy advice, but you also have to do things in line with the treaty principles, that creates a conflict of interest as well. And it really, if you've got a government like our one that's been elected in part to sort of push back on the overreach in some of the Maori stuff, then it brings into question whether the government is actually the public sector bureaucracy is actually able to serve the government and its agenda if it's got all these existing agreements with Maori organizations and it has to do things in accordance with the treaty principles. It's a similar problem to the media and the Public Interest Journalism Fund. And just to expand on that and to take it even wider, it's not just a problem with Maori stuff and the treaty principles, it's a problem with wokeism in general. So there's a culture in the public sector that has been deliberately created around trying to be trying to treat all these groups in a certain way. You've got to be fair, you're not allowed to offend anyone, all this stuff. And what that means is it makes it almost impossible to provide policy advice if you're working in there, like I used to do, that goes against the woke ideology. Because they'll pull you up on HR grounds. They'll say, well, this is offensive. You can't write it in there. You're offending these groups. But even if it's true, and even if it's good advice for other reasons. So, in order to have a properly functioning public sector, you kind of need to get rid of this, a lot of this treaty stuff, and get rid of a lot of this woke stuff, and drive cultural change, because this stuff is bedded in right at the top of these agencies.
The report mentioned specifically around your complaints that there were these complaints raised internally by Stats employees, and they were basically just ignored, as you said, because of this culture that's been built up.
Yeah, I'm
It's
taking things a bit wider
essentially
than.
mandatory for them to ignore these concerns that are raised because, oh, it's Maori issues, or it's a Maori organization. We got to let them do their thing. They waived various requirements like certificates of confidentiality. All kinds of systems were compromised by this because of it being a quote-unquote Maori issue.
Yeah, and I can tell you from working in there, if you would have, people would be very reluctant to bring up that Maori groups or iwi groups or Maori organizations were doing anything inappropriate because of potential accusations of racism. There's just a culture in there where you don't do that, or you're very tentative of doing that. And the same goes for a lot of the other woke stuff as well. So these organizations, like big businesses and big organizations, now have organizational strategies. And those organizational strategies include things like diversity, equity, and inclusion. And this goes particularly strongly for the government departments. Government, I was working in the government departments when they brought in pronouns. People started putting the pronoun things in their emails. There's just a culture where you wouldn't speak out against that for fear of, incurring the wrath or incurring consequences or harming your career or all this kind of thing. And so, what that means is a lot of true policy advice or good policy advice or ideas never get put into papers and never go up to ministers. And we can't have that situation anymore. We have to de-wokeify the public sector. So, you need to get staff in there at the top level with an agenda to drive this. We need to have staff turnover throughout the managerial hierarchy in the public sector to bring in people who aren't enthralled to this ideology. And there has to be a deliberate effort to stop doing things in the woke way and start doing them in a more normal way that would be more in line with what ordinary New Zealanders think is normal and appropriate.
And again, with these revelations, which basically confirmed, sort of for the most part, what people already knew and what we were have already reported on the show last year, basically all of the allegations were true, and yet they continue to deny them. John Tamahere, the Waipara Trust, and these other organizations connected with them continue to deny that they did anything wrong when it's pretty clear that they did something wrong. Hopefully, this means that they are completely cut out of government funds and grants and agreements, because there is a lot of money that gets funneled into these organizations that basically then get used to campaign against the government. In this case, it seems likely they stole a seat from the Labour Party. The Maori Party basically tampered with the election illegally, although there's no way to bring an official case against them. The police are still doing some investigations. But the Labour Party is very, very quiet on this because it seems like the Labour Party culture is completely in line with the public service. And there's no dissent allowed against this particular agenda. And I think the key thing that you've raised here for opposition parties, which the opposition parties are currently not doing, but I encourage people when you're trying to help these parties campaign next year, because there's going to be another general election next year, think very much about staffing. How are they going to fix the staffing in these public services? I've written for this on Right Minds and Z as well, around the just all of these Crown entities, including the real estate agency one, where the decisions are actually made by the staff, they're made by the board members, and they could be stopped at that level. They shouldn't need legislation or ministerial involvement. The staff should actually be implementing the government's agenda, and that's something that's not happening here. And the only way to do that is actually to change the staff and to have replacement staff ready to go, something that we have praised Trump for. doing in the United States, which is bringing the staff with him.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I would just like to agree with what you said around probably they probably got that seat because of the shenanigans that went on here. And I would just like to say there's so much government money in modern societies. Like power is wielded in large part via institutions, and so much government and taxpayer resource has gone into building up these Maori institutions like the Waipariri Trust, and they do a lot of things that aren't political and community building and things like that, but they also do things that are political as well. And taxpayer money really needs to not be used for political things. So there's this problem of not policing the line between political and non-political stuff that the government really needs to get on top of when it's doing business with non-government agencies.
This goes for the broader Maori nationalist movement in New Zealand. It's basically bankrolled by the taxpayer. If you look at where all this money is coming from for these organizations, basically iwi activist organizations, almost every single one of them is being bankrolled by the taxpayer. So you have this effectively subversive anti-New Zealand agenda that is being funded by the New Zealand taxpayer. It's a very terrible, terrible situation for us to be in. And it's not something that's going to be addressed by the National Party, but it is something that could potentially be addressed by other parties, as we go into the next election cycle. Something, as I'll reiterate here, important to keep in your mind as we go that way. I guess someone had to fall on their sword, and in this case, it was the Stats NZ boss, who's basically said that he is not seeking was it reappointment, or not seeking to extend his term. What does the accountability look like on this to you?
Well, we're used to a lot of situations where no one's ever held accountable at all and no one loses their jobs. But then he's voluntarily, it's not like he stood down immediately, but he's still agreed not to stand next time. So this is better than what we're used to in a lot of situations. And it's kind of noble that he would choose to do that. And so let's encourage things that are good here. It was good for someone to fall on their sword. But I think we really need to know more about this scandal and who are all the people to blame, because I don't think it all falls back to the head of Stats New Zealand. This is a deeper cultural problem right throughout the public sector.
And we'll see if the police investigation yields anything further on that in the future. We'll now move quickly to another police-related issue. And, whether or not the police do their job, and the IPCA, the Independent Police Complaints Authority, has released several reports this week, one into Albert Park, which was the Posey Parker rally speech that was supposed to take place that was completely destroyed by trans protesters. It got incredibly violent. She had to be taken away by the police. Several of the feminist supporters there were beaten by these trans men who came out, and this mob that was whipped up by the media and the establishment. And the IPCA report into that seems to be, for the most part, a whitewash. The basically no real blame put on the police for doing anything wrong. But there was another IPCA report released this week as well around the arrest of Lucy Rogers. She was a pro-Israel protester at a Palestine rally. She was arrested by the police. She went to the Police Complaints Authority. They went through a lot of effort on her part, on her behalf, and they actually ruled specifically saying that the police had lied about her, about the reasons they arrested her. It was completely unlawful for her for them to arrest her, and everything they did, the use of force was completely unjustified. The response by the police then, however, is, I think, even more damning, which is that they rejected the findings of the IPCA and said that they acknowledge the IPCA's views, but they believe that their officers were acting in the woman's best interest to keep her safe due to their previous experience of pro-Palestine events, and which can turn violent quickly. So police were found to have lied, and then the police defended themselves, and there's no consequences for police officers lying. In that case, Anything, any thoughts that you have in general on both of these IPCA reports?
Well, on the Albert Park one, what the report says is the initial risk assessment was incorrect, and they misjudged the size of the trans protesters, or the size of the crowd of trans protesters that would turn up. And so they thought they needed less officers there than what they had. And that as a result of that mistake, they didn't have enough officers there. And then they also didn't react quickly and forcefully enough to protect the Let Women Speak attendees when things started getting heated and the whatever you call it, the building in the center there got rushed by the protesters
Yeah,
and
it was
things
a
started getting
rotunda. I
the
was there, I
rotunda. That's
remember.
the
Yes.
rotunda. So, but I mean, what this, I think there's a wee bit of a game that might be being played here where they're putting it down to an innocent mistake when really it was, I think, a deliberate choice to deliberately misunderestimate the number of people they needed there so that the trans protesters could have their way. That is the conspiracy theory that I'm advancing here. I'm advancing that they did that deliberately because they wanted to use the thugs' veto on Posey Parker.
And in this case, the IPCA report didn't uncover that conspiracy. But as I said, it's good to
So that's what
contrast
I'm
this
saying.
with the other one. It's good to contrast this one with Lucy Rogers' one, where the IPCA did actually uncover a conspiracy on the police to lie. So
Well,
I'm just.
the issue with Lucy Rogers was it was too difficult for them to police the large crowd of pro-Palestine protesters. If it was with Palestine, I think it was Palestine. So they thought it was just easy to remove her from the situation. So you can
And,
see from a practical perspective why they would do that, but it's
but they
still
make this,
not quite
they
right.
try to make the same argument in the IPCA report for the Posey Parker protest, saying that maybe the police should have more powers to remove the people who are easier to remove. Same thing they try to do with Lucy Rogers, to say, well, let's remove the non-violent people who might be at risk of being harmed, and let's give the police powers to forcefully remove people who could be put in danger by violent protesters. Effectively, an argument that's being advanced by the police here. In both of these cases, is that they should have more powers to get rid of peaceful protesters or people who are peacefully having their way to enable the thugs' veto to be more effectively used, because the police can always get rid of the can always move on and claim that they're protecting the smaller and the more peaceful party by removing them from the situation and denying their right to be heard.
Yeah, well, you can see what will happen if they keep doing it that way, though. If you keep giving in to the crowd who has more people and looks more forceful, people are going to organize bigger, larger, more forceful crowds to silence their opposition. The police is just encouraging that behavior. So you can't do that in the long term. The police really need to enforce the law, even if it is the more difficult option that puts them more at risk. That's what needs to be done to preserve free speech.
And on that issue of free speech, I might quickly mention as well that Gareth, who's been interviewed by RCR a few times last year, by myself, sorry, Cam and I as well, he is back on X posting Knob Oddie Returns. And he has been posting screenshots of OIAs and Privacy Act requests that he has made to the police, basically detailing how behind the scenes, police were discussing how they were going to set him up and how they were following his posts online, even going to the point of trying to see if they could engage with him to get him to say something more extreme so they could go after him. Fascinating story that he has posted all of these screenshots for on X. I will actually go and interview him at some point in the future. This will be maybe next month. It's still a little while away for me to set that up, and we'll actually get that up on the screen for you so you'll be able to see all of the OIAs that he's made with the redacted information. This show now, the weekly roundup, is available in visual format, although we don't have fancy visuals for you before, but I'm hoping to do a show for RCR where we will actually go through these documents on just exactly the kind of nasty stuff that the police get up to. Now, the final domestic issue that we need to cover this week is around the immigration numbers. As you've called it on this show in the past, the Great Replacement Update. Let me know what did the the numbers look like for 2024?
Well, the net immigration was down significantly to around 25-ish thousand. I'm not sure if you've got the
It's
numbers right.
27,000.
27,000. So that's a significant fall of around 100,000 from the year before. But the reason for that is there's been fewer people coming in, although still it's a historically high amount of people coming in of around 150 odd thousand people coming in.
Which
Historically
I
high.
think is about 3% of the population is are people who, every year who arrive fresh. It doesn't mean the population's growing by that amount because there are also people who leave. But you think about the fact that the 3% have just stepped off a plane every year. So over the last, if you extrapolate that and you maintain those numbers, then in the space of 10 years, you'd have up to 30% of your population, arrive in that time. So you go, those are very, very high numbers.
Yeah, and we had a record brain drain of people leaving the country of about 120 something thousand. So the reason the net immigration number seems quite low, or back to historical norm of around 27,000, is that largely because of the huge numbers leaving. So if you have a high number coming in and a high number leaving, you take one minus the other, you get a relatively small number. But still, it's New Zealanders who are largely leaving and new immigrants coming in. So it's still changing the face of New Zealand. It's changing the type and character of the people who are here. So it's still a replacement of sorts. And we had another announcement today around the most common registered surnames for children born in New Zealand this year. And it was Singh and Kaur, I think. I'm not quite sure how you pronounce that, but these are Sikh names, and there's a sort of tradition in the Sikh community where all the men take up Singh and all the women take up Kaur. I'm not sure if that's 100%, but there's a lot of that that goes on. But this illustrates the huge and growing size of the Indian community in New Zealand, which is now one of the largest ethnic groups. I think it may have overtaken the Chinese community, and it's
Yes, it officially is the third largest ethnic group in New Zealand.
So after Europeans and Maori, now we've got Indians, and they've got some of the most populous surnames in the country. So this just shows the extent of the what we're calling the great replacement that's going on. New Zealand traditionally has had it's been a population of a European majority with a indigenous Maori minority. And now the culture is changing. We're bringing in lots of other groups, so Indians, Chinese, Filipinos, and lots of other ones as well. And we've been talking previously in this show, in this episode, about culture war, right? So all these issues are culture war issues, whether it's Posy Parker or Brian Tamaki or Lucy Rogers. All these protests are about culture war issues. And why do we have culture wars? We have culture wars because there are fundamental disagreements between different parts of the community about what's right, what's wrong, what's good, what's bad, and how we should do things and how we shouldn't do things, and whose values should hold sway in the public sphere. And the way I'm going to tie these two things together, the Great Replacement and the culture war, they tied together because the more of these different cultural groups you have in the country, the more of these different cultural battles between these different groups you're going to have all the time. And that's why this sort of thing is intensifying.
And we missed this last year because I was on holiday at the time, but just to really tie this together, there was a diplomatic incident and a referendum here that I could put that in quotes, a quote unquote referendum held, an unofficial one by the Sikhs in Auckland for a Sikh homeland back in India, and in Khalistani referendum, which caused an incident with the Indian embassy, and this was something that Winston Peters had to get involved in. So you'll see that, of course, the Sikh nationalists and the Hindu nationalists are debating their issues here in Auckland, and that's only going to become a bigger problem, as you say, all of these cultural issues of different ethnic groups around the world become our problems.
Yeah, and New Zealand, the part of what the problem with the Great Replacement is people worry we're losing our, not just our people, which is important, not just the people are changing, but the culture, the values, and the texture of society is something we're losing. And you can see why. If you bring in groups like lots of Muslim groups or Jewish groups, these are groups that historically have been much more sensitive to criticism and have favored hate speech laws, for example. And so the more of those types of communities like them, and the more cultural power they have, the more likely they are to use that power to call for hate speech restrictions, and the more likely you are to get them. And what we're seeing right around the Western world, in the UK, in Australia, everywhere, is people are looking for the solution to how do you manage this diversity? How do you manage these culture wars and these culture war conflicts? And the solution, unfortunately, that a lot of our leadership class are coming to is we're going to manage it through tamping down, through kind of authoritarian measures like taking people's freedom of speech away, implementing hate speech laws, through more government surveillance and spying, through taking away other freedoms, freedoms of association, having bigger government overall that's more invasive. So most people, I think, don't want that. They don't want a bigger, more powerful government that is more authoritarian and takes their freedoms away. And if that is the only way of managing these cultural conflicts that are occurring between these different groups that you've brought into the country, then the question is whether multiculturalism is a good policy that is serving our interests or not. And I would just put it to you that it's not.
And to continue down this thread of hate speech laws, two illustrations this week, one in Australia. New hate speech laws were pushed through the lower house of New South Wales Parliament, I believe. Again, under the guise of anti-Semitic hate speech, basically a number of anti-Semitic incidents, as we're talking, because of the Israel-Palestine issue. But now they've banning hate speech on a very broad range of topics. So if you are anti-Semitic, or if you're homophobic or sexist or whatever, then you can be convicted of a hate crime in New South Wales if this particular law passes, just as an example of bringing this all together.
Yeah, there are lots of anti-Semitic hate speech incidents. And as a result of this, the politicians have used it as a pretext to bring in more tougher hate speech laws. And it's not just the federal government in Australia who have recently passed hate speech laws. Australia has state governments, and various state governments are trying to bring in these laws as well in New South Wales and Victoria, most notably.
And as the election comes closer in Germany, another example recently, young people again, homes raided by the police, dragged off, charged with hate crimes for posting memes on the internet, in the lead up to the election in Germany. And again, why is that multicultural issue there? A very large number of migrants, both legal and illegal, in Germany, and how have they dealt with that in their typical German fashion of taking everything a step too far?
Yeah, well, the so-called far right is growing more popular because they are the only ones proposing any sort of reasonable solution to this. And the solution is to, first of all, stop more of these migrants coming in, and second of all, encourage some of the ones that are there to leave, which we call remigration. And a lot of people are that extremely emotionally, politically committed to the multicultural project. And they will do almost anything to stop the far right from putting a stop to the multicultural project, including taking away your freedoms, your freedom of speech, even if it means doing raids, politically motivated raids on people for posting memes on the internet. And JD Vance gave a speech in Europe recently on this issue where he called it out. He called out the Europeans for their embrace of hate speech laws and their problem of mass migration. And these things are all related, as we can see.
And since we're talking about international topics, I'll quickly mention the Ukraine war potentially being negotiated to an end in the next few weeks, if we're incredibly optimistic. But there seems to basically be an agreement between Russia and America that there need to be elections held in Ukraine. There needs to be a ceasefire, and elections need to be held. If you look at the polling in Ukraine, there's a reason why Ukraine supporters don't want this. The polling in Ukraine is that Zelensky's number one opponent, and I haven't got his name in front of me right now, but he's a general who was fired by Zelensky for disagree him disagreeing with him about handling the war. This particular general is currently polling out polling Zelensky 2-1 in terms of winning an election if it were held in Ukraine today. So there could be some very, very interesting things going on in the Ukraine in the near future. But what do you think on the whole about Trump's response to deal with this problem? He obviously promised to end the war. Is he doing this in a way that ends well for Ukraine?
Well, I mean, I think the only reasonable way to end it will be with territorial concessions to Russia, and I think that that seems like that's on track to be what will happen. The eastern part of Ukraine, which has a lot of Russian-speaking people in it, and at different parts and times of history has been part of Russia, will probably be given back to Russia. I guess the risk with the election thing. Is that, I mean, I don't know about this particular general, but if Zelensky is unpopular, there's a risk that a new president or a new government could be more pro-Russian. And that would be a lot of the Europeans and the Americans who have put time into fighting there and the Ukrainians themselves, that would be a terrible outcome. So, yeah, very difficult to figure out
It's
how it's going to go from here at this early stage.
yes, exactly. And I think I would put forward the counter argument too. There's always the possibility you get someone who's more pro-European, because obviously the Europeans have, and this is perhaps part of Trump's negotiating to get the Europeans to take over the role in the situation, because the Americans are saying, hey, no thanks, we're done with this. We've had to pour $200 billion in, and we don't know where the half of it's gone. If the Europeans want to continue fighting, then they should pony up the money to keep paying for the war. Whether or not that will happen, we just don't know at this stage.
When I say pro-Russian, I just want to clarify. What I mean is a lot of people believe that Zelensky is basically managed effectively by
Well,
NATO and Europe and Western
by the
powers.
C he's basically
And
run by the
that we're,
CIA. I think we can just go say that it's
yeah. And
managed by the
so
CIA.
the worry is that a new candidate may not be. And then you did all that fighting for nothing if he comes in and he does something you don't want to happen there.
Well, it will be interesting for sure. We are a little bit over time, but I think I'm just going to go back to one point for us to finish on, because we talked about the Great Replacement, we talked about the culture war, we talked about the police protests, and we do need to talk a little bit about who is pushing back in New Zealand. We had a number of great moments in Parliament with Winston Peters and Shane Jones, in particular versus Ricardo Mendez, the Mexican Green MP. I mean, what are your thoughts on all of this? Because it's very, very interesting to see Winston Peters and Shane Jones really come to bat for New Zealand as a name, New Zealand as the country, versus what the woke have been doing, which is trying to replace and just basically destroy New Zealand and replace it with this thing called Aotearoa. They use Aotearoa not as a translation for New Zealand, but it's not a translation, but it's a replacement of New Zealand, and you're talking about the Great Replacement. So, what are your opinions on Winston Peters and Shane Jones just before we go?
It's a good point, Aotearoa being a replacement. It's so that's the name for the so they're waging a cultural Marxist revolution, and once the revolutionary overthrow happens, the name for the new state in which the traditional European majority, which has been dominant, has been displaced and disempowered, it'll be called Aotearoa then, be re-indigenized, as Rauiri Waititi might say. But this spat in Parliament between New Zealand First, Winston and Shane Jones, and Ricardo Menendez March was quite clarifying. So, I mean, I support keeping the country named New Zealand, although, I mean, I don't think Aotearoa was ever actually the name. I think it was the name of the North Island.
Correct. Historically, it was the name of the North Island, but it's sort of been adopted by Maori nationalists as the name for all of New Zealand. And it was sort of
But
recognized.
there's been this sort of sneaking way of trying to sneak in Aotearoa. The politicians have been using it. The public sector's been using it. That they're just wanting to
It's
sort of.
even on the passports now. It's the first thing on this replace New Zealand on the passports. That's how bad it's gotten.
No one. There's been never been any referendum. The majority of New Zealanders have never wanted that. They're trying to force it just through sneaking it in and forcing it and using media power and. and to normalize it and then just sort of make it happen after it's become normalized. So that's not a democratic way of doing things. That's a top-down thing that's being imposed on the current population against their will. And Winston and Shane Jones are correct to call that out. But what I was really interested in was the response that came after that, where David Seymour criticized, rather than criticizing Ricardo Menendez March, he criticized Winston and Shane Jones for criticizing Ricardo. He was upset at their, so I guess their anti-immigrant, he thought it was an
Yeah, he was
anti-immigrant
upset
type thing.
at referring to him as an immigrant who had arrived in 2006, saying that it doesn't matter whether you arrived in 1300s or 1840 or 2025, that you should be treated exactly the same in New Zealand. That's David Seymour's position.
Yeah, so it doesn't matter what
And
our
they're just as Kiwi.
local.
I'm not just talking about the law here. I'm saying you should be seen as just as Kiwi. So if you just stepped off the plane yesterday, you're just as a Kiwi as anyone who's been here for hundreds of years.
Yeah, so that attitude means that our unique identity and culture as New Zealanders is basically worth nothing to David Seymour, and that someone else who can come in from a different country, Timbuktu, and can jump off the plane and be just as New Zealander as he gets here. The problem with this way of thinking is that people aren't really like that.
It's a
People
blank
have
slate theory, right? Like people are just
it's
a
a
blank
blank
slate that you write over the top of,
that's
and magic
right.
dirt turns them into whatever you need them to be.
And if we go back to what I was saying earlier about the culture wars, these culture wars are being driven by the fact we've got these different cultural groupings in New Zealand. And David Seymour seems to think if we all just stopped focusing on identity, that those problems would go away. But I don't think that that's true. The problem isn't some bug in people's brains, some bad idea around identity, because people's identity isn't just skin deep. It's not just some ephemeral idea. It's extremely deep. It's in your bones, it's in your blood, it's in your DNA. The way people behave is rooted in that biology, at least in significant part. And even the cultural aspects, they take a lot of time to relearn and undo and do differently. So it's not a reasonable expectation that you can bring a whole bunch of people here from different foreign countries from all over the world, and then expect them to just sort of assimilate at the snap of your fingers, and you can do without all these cultural conflicts. The cultural conflicts are being created by the immigration and multicultural policies, not by a fixation on identity.
Well, thank you very much for that. We've gone well over my expected time, but I very much enjoyed that. I hope the audience did too. And we will be back next week with another weekly roundup.
Thanks, Stuart.